Today on Different Matters, I interview the Honourable Christopher Finlayson. We talk about his book, He Kupu Turangi. We talk about the treaty settlement process. We talk about his role in it. And we cover off the legal personalities and the interaction between his views of the law and the treaty settlement process. I hope you enjoy it. On my podcast, Different Matters, I'm here with the Honourable Christopher Finlayson. Chris, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You've written a book. This is your second book, and you've promised three. I'm quite interested in the third one. But today we're going to talk about your book, He Kupu Turangi. So before we start, what does the title mean?
Well, the way I interpret it is the promise of the future. It's supposed to be a very optimistic book, a book that recognises all the good work that's been done over a number of generations, particularly since the formation of the tribunal in 1975, treaty settlements through the 90s and 2000s, and the promise of the future.
I want to start with the treaty itself and the different interpretations of it. You criticised Jacinda Ardern, saying that the treaty was between Māori and Pākehā, and you described the treaty as being between Māori and the Crown, and you repeat that throughout the book. When I read the treaty, and we'll come in on the interpretation of it, but I read it as between the chiefs and the Crown, and you make a big emphasis later in the book about iwi and the Crown. So who, when we're looking at the Māori side of the treaty, who are we dealing with? Who is on the other side?
I actually don't think I was criticising Ardern any more than I was criticising Seymour when I was pointing out that it is wrong to characterise the treaty as one between races, because it's not. It was a treaty which was negotiated for and on behalf of iwi by Rangatira and the Crown. But that's not a criticism, that's simply an observation.
No, fair enough. But who, because you also make the point, and jumping ahead of myself, that there would, at one point when the Crown goes to negotiate, who do they negotiate with? And in the past they may have looked to the Māori Council, but now increasingly they're looking towards iwi. And so I come back to that question, who, when we're dealing with the Treaty of Waitangi, who is the Crown negotiating with? Is it Māori? Is it iwi? Is it chiefs? Who is the other side?
Oh, I think that's a very important question, and one that can take a lot of time at the mandate stage. The Crown has to know that those with whom it is negotiating in a particular iwi or hapu group are going to be able to bind that group. And so these negotiations would never be conducted with the Māori Council, which is a sort of a pan-iwi group, which has probably outlived its usefulness in any event. But it has to know that those with whom it deals in these negotiations will be able to bind the group.
So you were in cabinet and you had three portfolios: treaties, Attorney General and the arts. What was it about, because in your book, Yes Minister, you talked that this was an area that you were particularly interested in, and you've had an outsized impact when you look at people in the role of the Crown negotiating with treaties. You have had an enormous impact. I think you're right that since the early 90s, two-thirds of the treaties have been signed under your governance, your role. What was it about that? Was it you were the right person in the right place at the right time, or was there something about Christopher Finlayson that says this is historically important and I need to do this? Because you drove this. This would not have happened, I think, without your pushing it.
Well, that's very kind, but the way I looked at being a minister is that the curtain goes up the day you're sworn in and you're on stage, and you know not when the curtain will come down, so you better get on with it. And soon after I was appointed, in early January of 2009, I went on a hikoi, started off in Tairawhiti, visited the various iwi there, and then went to other places around the country, and I did push it along. I get aggravated when I hear some people say, oh, well, he dealt with the low-hanging fruit, as though any negotiation's low-hanging fruit, which is actually insulting to iwi and insulting to me. And many of the negotiations I pushed were extraordinarily difficult. But I was conscious that Jim Bolger and Doug Graham had started an extremely important process for our country, one that the former special rapporteur who came out to New Zealand in about 2010 said was, in terms of historic reconciliation, the best system he'd come across.
Let's talk about, I think, one of the most difficult negotiations and successes. This is Tūhoe. So this is relatively late in the book, but I want to talk about this early on because there are so many things about this particular story that I'm embarrassed to admit I did not know and did not understand until I read your book. And that's actually one of the things I like about the book. You talk about Parihaka at one point, and you say that the mere settlement itself forced Parihaka onto the national stage and agenda, and certainly that was true from my case. But let's just talk about Tūhoe. This is a such an important and such an interesting case. But maybe before we talk about that, you talk about the history of Tūhoe and their relationship with is it Te Uruwera's?
Oh, yes, yeah, Te Uruwera.
Te Uruwera, sorry. So talk about the history of the Tūhoe, because cripes, that's interesting. Because they never signed the treaty.
No, it's a very interesting story. And do you know, it's one where people regard them as standoffish and unfriendly. One very interesting thing I found out was that the first director, I think it was, I think he was the first, of the Nelson School of Music, was a German who liked tramping. I think he came from Dusseldorf. And off he went into the Uruweras once with his fiddle and was entertaining the Tūhoe, and they were entertaining him with their instruments. They are a very interesting iwi, and their members are very interesting. I also know a person who told me, a lawyer from Blenheim who likes tramping, he could leave his car at Ruatahuna and go tramping for several weeks in the Uruweras, come back. He left the car unlocked. It was just as though he had just left it 5 minutes ago. So the idea that it's an unfriendly, inhospitable place is simply wrong. It's a fascinating place. And what I found so interesting in terms of the history is that they had been basically locked out of any decision-making over their homeland over several generations. And then, as we know, in the mid-2000s, there was that raid on Ruatoki, and the police were standing on the confiscation line. Children were traumatised, people were generally terrified. It was a botch-up, and ex post facto, the police go back and apologise and so on, but those mistakes should never have been made. So I was aware of all those sorts of issues when we came to negotiate, and was very keen to get a just and a durable settlement.
Tūhoe never signed the treaty, and they remained control of their lands up until 1865. They effectively land confiscations instigated by the Crown, war raged up until 1871. Fascinating guy called Tukuti charging around. They received some form of self-governance in 1896.
Which is very interesting. If you read that legislation,
the 1896 one.
Yeah. After Seddon visited, you see the quite significant self-government or self-determination. And so when I was dealing with them, they were aware of their history. The institutional crown had long forgotten about it because new generations of civil servants had come in. But Tuhoe were aware of their history. They knew what they had bargained for with Seddon. They knew what they wanted.
So the crown generally, they as is the want with the crown, they didn't stick to that agreement, and the Tierra was their land was consistently encroached upon, and you write in the book that that only 16% remained.
That's right. And then in 1953, I think it was Ernie Corbett, who was in Sid Holland's cabinet, made it a national park without any consultation whatsoever, and again locked out of the running of their homeland. And then, of course, when they start raising concerns about it, people say, oh, well, it's a public asset. Don't be so selfish.
So this, the creation of the National Park in 1954 and the way that that plays out is really interesting. And I guess that's the bit that I really wanted to talk about, because it plays in to a lot of the other things that happen. So you go down there and you do a deal, and the initial deal didn't get through cabinet. You write about your own valley of tears. In fact,
I drove past the seat just the other day and was joking about it to some of my friends from Naitakato. I said, oh, there's my seat where I sat and wept. What had happened was that Hone Harawira had asked me to go up north to speak to some of his whānau about the proposed changes to the marine and coastal legislation. And so I flew up there. The civil servants were flying to Kerikeri, but as usual, that was fogged out, so they couldn't land. So I land at Kaitaia and then go round near Cooper's Beach to give my speech without any officials or any support, emerge from the hui. And then when I got in cell phone range, the cell phone started exploding, and I saw a text from English saying, Tuhoe deal won't proceed, too much cabinet opposition. So I had to try and find a place where I had a signal. It's much better there now, by the way. And sat on the seat, and I call it my seat of tears. And then had to drive back to Auckland because all the flights were messed up. And so all in all, I remember that day as a day from hell.
Why did the cabinet say no?
Well, no deal had actually been concluded. There had been discussions, and I think I've never known the full story, but I think some people in the cabinet may have got advice from others that working with national parks in this way was dangerous, given the importance of national parks to the general body politic.
So the provisional deal that was negotiated was that the Te Uruweras would be transferred to Tuhoe, effectively fee simple. That was the deal.
It was to be a transfer and a considerable level of governance ability, and also public access was going to be assured.
Okay. Now, that was a bridge too far for your cabinet colleagues.
In 2010, that was a 2010. Yes, it was 2010. Bridge too far.
So then Christopher Finlayson gets creative, and boy, did you get creative. And also because you're the Attorney General at the same time and a lawyer, so you're familiar with all of this stuff. You write in the book a quote from Sir John Salmon talking about things that can be legal persons. And you quote him, legal persons, being the arbitrary creations of the law, may be as many kind the law pleases. Those which are actually recognised by our own system, however, are as comparatively few types. You go on to quote a US Supreme Court judgment, which says that a ship has a legal personality, so does a company. Why not valleys, rivers, lakes? Why not the Te Aruas?
That's right.
This is so interesting. I'm still trying to grapple my head around exactly what it is that you did. You vested the Tiaruas in itself. So talk through that, because this was this the first time, because this concept then flows on to other arrangements.
Oh, no, yeah, but the point you're making is there's really nothing new under the sun. Sir John Salmond, who was Solicitor General well over 100 years ago and the author of a number of texts which continue to this day, Salmond on Torts is one.
He's a Kiwi.
Great legal mind. Mm. He had talked in his book on jurisprudence along the lines of what you've just quoted. And then there was some work done by a professor at UCLA on the subject. Funnily enough, in New Zealand, in 1996, a former dean of the law faculty of Victoria University, who taught me private international law and comparative law, Professor Tony Angelo, had written along these lines as well. And so I had some excellent officials led by a really fine lawyer called John Grant, who subsequently did a lot of work on reform of Te Ture Whenua, and I'll come to that if you're interested. And we started to talk through this idea of legal personality and natural resources. And as I often did, and I refer to it in the book, a former partner of mine, Peter McKenzie, who had been chair of the Securities Commission and also a senior lecturer in company law for years, one of the most creative minds I had come across in the law, I said to the officials, "We'll go and kick the tires and get Peter to have a look at it." And he came back with a magisterial opinion that said, yeah, in principle, there's no reason why this can't be done. And so there was a lot of collaborative, it was a really interesting collaborative and positive time, and we came up with this idea.
So you formulated a plan whereby the region, the Tiaruas, could be essentially vested in itself.
Yes, that's right. Get away from the idea of crown ownership.
Yeah, so it would no longer be a national park.
It would be taken out of the national parks regime, but the legislation governing it would have many of the aspects of a national park, but it is not a national park.
And it was governed initially by a 50-50 co-governance arrangement for 3 years, and then a two-third, one-third, third, tūhoe.
That's right.
Crown. And that, I mean, as an outsider, you really need to think about this, because if you're looking at this as an outsider, you're going to think, well, what fundamentally is the difference between the first deal and the second deal? And so, practically speaking, what was the difference between tūhoe having effective ownership of it and the forest having its own legal identity?
Well, funnily enough, I think the second version is more in line with the tūhoe, indeed Māori, view of resources. It's not a sort of a Western view of ownership, so it's a more consistent approach. It's a cleverer approach.
That the land, the mountains, the rivers have their own separate character and personality.
And they subsist long after we've moved on or down or up. The Whenua stays.
I want to ask you this as well, because this is interesting. And I'm not sure that I agree with you, but I want to tease it out. You apologised to tūhoe for the Crown for not having honoured the treaty, but tūhoe were never parties to the treaty. From my layman's experience, I think the Crown should have apologised for its misdeeds under its own law. The Crown's behaviour, the way it treated people that the Crown considered its own citizens, was a violation of its own internal rules. So why not apologise for that?
That's a fair enough point. But one doesn't take a legalistic approach that when the Crown came in, its responsibilities in and over this country could not be avoided by the simple fact that groups who were remote had not had the opportunity of considering and signing the treaty.
Was that the case with the Tūhoe? I thought the Tūhoe had considered it, and then maybe my ignorance, but I thought they considered signing and rejected it.
I'd need to sort of go back through my history, but there were certainly groups that were deemed too inaccessible. They were never approached.
You write that you met somebody, an elderly individual, whose first and only language was Te Reo.
Yeah, that was up toward in that sort of border area between Kahanunu and Tūhoe up around Waikare Moana. But it was a very interesting experience when I was in a helicopter going across the various parts of Te Uruwera.
Do you think somebody who doesn't have the training in the law in the way that you did and the level that you did could have achieved the same outcome? Was an understanding of the law...
I think Michael Cullen could have. He was very keen to get a settlement up there. And the more I look at that man's career, the more I respect it. He was... he was very sharp-tongued and brutal, but then I could turn it back on him. But he was very interested in the treaty negotiations portfolio, and in a short amount of time achieved a lot. I think also he was haunted by the foreshore and seabed debacle. He was actually extraordinarily useful when we were looking at changing the foreshore and seabed legislation. I always am very grateful to him for a letter he wrote that was very, very helpful. So I had huge respect for Cullen, and that respect for Cullen, and I might say Clark, grows with the passage of time.
Just before we leave this particular topic, because we come on to Māori Tonga and other bits and pieces, but the current management plan, which I think you quote in the book as well, says, this is the current management plan for the forest. The use of property rights by the Western legal system has hidden from view the concept of nature. The use of property rights to regulate human affairs, disputes arising from society, is no longer permissible in and of Te Uruwera. The Uruwera may never again be owned by people. So,
I think we can. I mean, I'm a great property rights person, and I would say that most of the problems in this country, I don't look at from a sort of a social justice-y point of view. I look at it from a property rights point of view, that if the property rights of tangata whenua had been respected, then we wouldn't have half the problems that we have in this country now.
And this is because you draw the distinction between National and Labour, and because you write about Margaret Wilson, who viewed treaty settlements as a means of closing the gaps, and you write that the National Party saw it more as a violation of property rights that need to be corrected. And do you think that's still the case? I mean, you're looking at the previous Ardern regime. Did Labour adopt your kind of view on the property rights, or did they slap laps back?
Oh, I don't know. I think Andrew did a good job. He got the Taranaki one through. I was always very keen on that one, so he got that one, and was dealing with a number of other settlements. But the suggestion that I had all the easy ones was just frankly dopey.
Okay. All right. Well, my suspicion is that there are no easy ones.
There are no easy ones because they all turn on their own facts and their own history. And there are no straightforward negotiations.
No, let's talk about. I want to go on a little detour because you go on one that's so interesting. The Motunui.
Oh yeah, I was telling. I teach part of the conflict of laws course at Victoria University, and I was telling them yesterday about the Motunui panels. Do you want me to
throw in the kidnapping as well, because that is just so cool.
It's a fascinating story. So what happened was in the 1970s, these panels had been unearthed in a bog near Waitara, and they were the finest example of North Taranaki carving that you could come across. For some reason, they were secreted out of New Zealand by someone within Te Ati Awa. They seem to know who it was.
How old were they?
150 years. I think it could have gone back to when some of the northern iwi were coming down.
You write in the book it was carved about pre-1820, which means that's incredibly old.
That's right. And
they survived in the swamp.
They survived. For some reason, they survived in the swamp, yeah. And so they end up at one of the auction houses in London, and the then Attorney General for New Zealand, Jim McClay, commenced a proceeding in the High Court over there, and it went all the way to the House of Lords. And the basic underlying ratio of the case was that you can't enforce in England a New Zealand penal statute, and certain parts of the Antiquities Act, which we were relying on, came into that category of a penal statute. And so there are limits to sovereignty, and New Zealand's sovereignty can't be imposed in England. And so it gave rise to a lot of discussion in various international cultural fora about the illegal export of treasures. And I was always very interested in it. And I remember a debate when I was in opposition. By this time, the Antiquities Act was called the Protected Objects Act, and there was an amendment to it, and I was going on about the Motunui panels, and Mahara Okoroa, who was the MP for Te Tai Tonga, came up to me and said, oh, can we have a chat about that? That's really interesting. And so he and I sat down and had a chat, and he was actually raised in Parihaka, and there had been numerous attempts to get these panels back, but I was so lucky it happened on my watch. And the Lewis Holden, who was the head of culture and heritage, came and saw me one morning and said, Minister, I need to give you a briefing on a very interesting matter concerning what are called the Motunui panels. And I said, well, I know all about it because I've read Attorney General for New Zealand and Ortiz. And that gave rise to negotiations. So the long and the short of it was we negotiated the purchase of them. They're back, and they are at Pukeariki, and they are truly amazing examples of North Taranaki carving. And I remember the emotional day at Pukeariki when the panels came back, and I think John Key was there with me, and there was much sort of wailing and gnashing of teeth and so on. But the fact of the matter is it was a Te Ati Awa person who'd flogged them off in the first case. And so we got them back, and they are now in that museum in perpetuity. And they are cared for by, I think the trustees are, there are a couple of Te Ati Awas, the local member for Te Tai Hararu, and the local member for New Plymouth. And so I can tell you now, they won't be secreted to an auction house in London ever again.
It cost the taxpayer $4.5 million, but it seems like that was probably spent.
Oh, yeah, but they are invaluable. And, I mean, imagine if we had turned down the offer. And the point you made is they were put up on sale in London because the Ortiz family were from Bolivia and they made their money in tin, surprise, surprise, and one of the family had been kidnapped and they needed to get some money for a ransom, as it turned out. They sorted that particular grisly matter out and they didn't need to sell off the panels. And the Ortiz family were in Geneva, and Mr. Ortiz Sr. had a great interest in indigenous art. But there was a fellow from the University of East Anglia or something, Stephen Hooper, who had liaised with the family. And there was a general understanding in the Ortiz family that really these panels did belong in New Zealand. And so we negotiated their return, and I invited Mrs. Ortiz, by this time a widow, and her son and Professor Hooper to come out to New Zealand as our guests for the signing of the I think it was the Te Ati Awa Deed of Settlement. So it was just, it all fell into place very well.
and because you've got Lord Denning, you've got all of these interesting characters. As a lawyer, it must have been just fascinating.
Well, it was especially going back to the fact that, and I mentioned Professor Tony Angelo, that the issue had been touched on when I was studying the conflict of laws in the late 1970s, and little did I know that it would come back and be something that I'd have to deal with on my watch. And one of the more satisfying aspects of it, and there's a lovely photo which appears somewhere, it might be in the book, but elsewhere, is there's a photo of Jim McClay and me at Pukeariki, and the article is entitled "The Attorneys General and the Motunui Panels." And so two attorneys general had been working hard to get them back.
Well done. Perry Hackett, I want to talk about that. It came to my attention, I think, as a result of the treaty settlements that you did. So 1870, you write, it appears to be the largest Maori village in the country. Apparently only about 3,000 people, that surprises me. But anyway, the Crown, as was often the case, acted badly. 1881, there was an invasion, 1,500 troops charge in. This is a piece of history that had, at least from the Pākehā mind, completely vanished. But it hadn't for the local iwi. So, because this seems to be a particularly potent settlement.
Yeah, it's a very interesting point you make. It had vanished. I think there's a bit of communal suppression of history up that way. And had it vanished, or they just sort of swept it under the carpet? I think the general feeling was, well, what happened there was not flash.
I mean, I don't know.
But Jim Bolger had grown up around there because his parents emigrated from Ireland and lived around that part. He didn't know anything about it. Joan Bolger used to catch the bus to school with the Parihaka kids. She didn't know much about it. So I think it was more communal suppression of memory, actually.
So talk about the settlement, because that does seem to have had particularly profound impacts.
Yeah, well, let's go back to Maui Pomare Day. I think it was 2009. I rocked up there and said, wouldn't it be great to complete all the settlements in these parts? And apparently some of the officials went back and told the director of the Office of Treaty Settlements, and his reaction was apoplectic, because he said what? But I was the minister, and I could.
Why was he reluctant? What was his objection?
Oh, I think that they were regarded as very difficult settlements, right. And it was always intended that they would be toward the end of the settlement process. But I had different ideas, because I was personally interested in what had happened up there.
Mm.
And so we signed terms of negotiation with Te Ati Awa and with Taranaki and Naruahine. And I was always extraordinarily fond of Paul Swain, who was a Labour minister and the MP for Rimutaka. And so I asked him if he'd like to do some negotiations for me after he left Parliament, and he was very, very good. And I remember the day he came into my office and said, well, they've raised in the Taranaki meeting the need for resolution of Parihaka. And I said, well, we've dealt with that. And he said, well, they don't think we have. So the Taranaki settlement couldn't be finalised until we had a fresh look at Parihaka. And I asked Jim Bolger and Tariana Turia and a couple of others to do some work in it. And we came up with a proposal. Very interesting. We had to work out how to apologise, because the Crown had tried to apologise to Parihaka on a number of occasions. I think Helen Clark even tried. But we had to find out from them what they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So I went up there one Sunday afternoon, and we had a discussion, and we worked out what their expectations were. And it was a very carefully negotiated apology. We were admitting rape on the part of Crown officials for the first time. And it was very sensitive. And at length, they indicated they were prepared to be apologised to. And so I remember the day extremely well because I landed in New Plymouth and I was very interested to get the exit polls from the UK election, which would be coming out at 10 o'clock, you know, when Big Ben chimes and so on. And it was that was Theresa May's election. And we were just going round the mountain when the clock chimed 10 and I lost coverage. So I have to confess that for at least part of the day I was secondarily interested in that particular issue.
That's a terrible confession.
And then we went back around the mountain and found out that it was a monumental stuff-up on Theresa May's part.
She'll be coming round the mountain when she comes.
Yeah. Well, she, she was totally gone. But that was just a very interesting day, but I'll never forget all those eyes on me as I apologised. And it was a beautiful day for Parliament because we had people like Catherine Della Hunty was there, Andrew Little turned up, there were Māori Party people there. It was just a great day for Parliament. There was no New Zealand First representative, and I don't think David Seymour wasn't there, but the two big parties were well represented, as with the other ones. And the Chief Justice came along because she was aware of Sir James Prendergast's actions. So it was just a great day for New Zealand, actually.
So what was Prendergast's action?
Oh, well, there's a book that's been written about Sir James, Villain or Good Guy.
He was the one that wrote the legal nullity, was that him?
That's him. And he also made certain orders about locking up various people from Parihaka.
That's an interesting... David Williams wrote a book on that. Williams believes that Prendergast didn't actually write that joke. But anyway,
that's very interesting. Yeah, well, David would know these things because he's probably one of the preeminent scholars in the area.
Anyway, sorry, we're getting off track. Yep. So we're dealing with the apology.
Mm.
Could you also quote Sir Douglas Graham talking about apologies? And you quote him saying in Parliament, "But how can a wrong be righted without an acknowledgement of the wrong and expression of the regret that it occurred?"
That's right.
I think it's a powerful statement. One of the other things that comes out...
Yeah, but by the way, when you're talking about apology, it's not, "Oh, sorry." It's looking at the facts. Professional historians on both sides carefully negotiating it, because there's a justice element to previous generations as well. We have to be certain that we're not, in apologising in the 21st century, maligning the good efforts of a lot of people in the 19th century. So one has to be careful that we are apologising for the real thing. We're just not pro forma apologising.
Right. That makes sense. But that does seem to be... Well, coming from your book, that seems to be the most profound... or the most significant apology. Maybe that's...
Well, I know it annoyed people because I got a couple of letters afterwards condemning me for apologising for rape and some, very nasty stuff that emerges. I've said before, it's almost a cliche because I say it so often, Mrs. Thatcher is right. The veneer of civilization is very thin, and there are some elements in New Zealand, and we've seen evidence of it in the last couple of years, pretty ugly types. I call them the sour right, and they don't like any of this stuff.
Yes, okay, all right, you could be right. Let's talk about name changes. More generally, so the Mount Egmont-Taranaki change was not a treaty issue. That seemed to have happened almost organically over time.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. It was for some years, well, Ven Young, Jonathan's dad, and Audrey's dad did that in the 1970s, and so for a while it was called Mount Egmont-Taranaki, but the Egmont sort of faded away, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's interesting. The Araki Mount Cook That does appear to have been a treaty settlement with Ngāi
Tahu. Yeah, I think that arose out of the treaty settlement, that's right.
When is Mount Cook coming back?
I think it's fading away as well, isn't it?
No. I mean, because the deal with
Ngāi
Tahu was the gift being vested in
that's
the
right.
iwi and then coming back.
Yeah, but they've said they don't want it because the idea is... We can't go creating sort of natural resources with legal personality popping up all around the place, but that would be an obvious example of where what's happened with Taranaki should happen with Aoraki. And I can't see why we can't take a fresh look at that one.
Well, at the moment, the mountain is owned by Ngāi Tahu.
No, it's not, because it hasn't been triggered.
Oh, you mean the gifting... Sorry, I misunderstood that. So
yeah, the gifting hasn't taken place. That part of the settlement hasn't happened.
Ah, so the process by which the Crown vests it in the iwi and then the iwi give it back to the Crown, you're saying that part of the Ngāi Tahu settlement hasn't happened?
Correct.
Ah, okay, all right, I misunderstood. I got the impression that the first part had happened, but that... Okay, all right. I want to talk about Miranda.
Yep.
A local village had been called Pukaokuru.
Yep.
It had been blockaded by a ship, HMS Miranda.
Correct. They had bombarded it.
So Ngāti Pora, how do I pronounce that? The local
iwi wanted the original name back.
But the name Miranda, all Miranda had been was a ship that had bombed the local village,
yeah.
And the town became called Miranda, which was a bit appalling for the locals and their descendants who had to live there.
Yeah,
outrageous behaviour by the.
I mean, all around the place we're getting name changes, but you know it's not simply limited to English names to. Maori names, the one that always amuses me, if I stay at the Rutherford Hotel in Nelson, you just walk up the road a bit and you see Synagogue Lane, formerly Church Lane.
Oh, really?
And it started off as Synagogue Lane. I suppose the local Anglicans got it changed to Church Lane, and then it's back as Synagogue Lane again. So, you know, these things happen from time to time around the place, and it's kind of nice that the old names reemerge.
You get into more angry letters. I want to explore a little bit more the idea of a legal entity. So, just talk me through the timing. Was the two-horse limit, was that the first time that particular concept had been deployed?
Yes, and then we employed it with the Whanganui River settlement. Those people, you've really got to give it to the Whanganui folk. They had been pushing for resolution of that issue for over 100 years. And they'd gone to court, they'd gone to parliament, they'd petitioned everyone. There was a case called Inri, the bed of the Whanganui River. And an old buddy of mine, George Barton, outstanding, he was the lawyer for Fitzgerald and Fitzgerald and Muldoon. And he had acted as a junior in the case of Inri, the bed of the Whanganui River, and he was telling me one day over coffee that he was up in Taumarunui briefing a witness who got very upset, and so this guy went away and came back, and it was clear he'd been sitting in the river.
What, during the trial?
No, during the briefing process.
Oh, okay.
And the idea of... I am the river and the river is me. And so there was an identification with the river which was profound.
Because you're right that the local iwi never relinquished possession or control over the river, and they were protesting as back as 1873.
And then you see what had happened, that the paddle steamers came in, the eel wares were destroyed, the Tongariro power development. Have you ever been up there?
No.
The way rivers are literally, they vanish, go into drains, and a whole lot of water is turned north. And so it's a really interesting matter. And farming practices, so the river had got denuded. And, you know, when you fly from Wellington to Auckland, if there's been a storm or something, you see the amount of muck that pours out into the Tasman from the Whanganui. So something's wrong up there, and it's going to take a long while to put it back into natural order. But those sorts of issues had been the subject of contention by Māori for many years.
Looking at that from a natural, from a property rights perspective, I understand that. Looking at that from a, because you do write that in terms of the conservation, the iwi were kind of had particular knowledge or whatever. But see, I struggle with that a little bit. I'm much more comfortable with the idea that this is their property, they can do with it what they like, and if they do it well or they screw it up, then...
Well, no, because given the passage of time, there are different interests in the river, and for some water bodies around the country, maybe that attitude would be right. I mean, take, for example, the Arahura River on the west coast near Hokitika. As far back as the 1850s, people were saying, oh, don't go up there, it belongs to the Māori. And they actually exercise control over it now. Mm. And so there are some water bodies where that principle could well apply. And it's a very interesting issue about who owns the water in there.
Well, because I think you're right at one point that the ownership of water isn't something that... that is countenanced by English law, but of course that may well be changing. Before we let you go, let's talk about co-governance, because cripes, that's a hot button issue. Well, maybe less now, but maybe more now. When I look at co-governance and I look at the co-governance arrangement that you had negotiated in particular about rivers and the Te Aroas and so forth, I look at that and I say, well, okay, if this is an asset that the Crown confiscated or took out of iwi ownership, and then as a process of that settlement, there is an agreement by which, okay, we're going to do co-governance because we took what is yours and we're gonna negotiate. To my mind, that's okay, because I believe in property rights, and if we stole your property, we have to compensate you, we can't make you whole, whatever, we can do a deal. But that is, I think, a conceptually different thing from where you are looking at co-governance, particularly, I'm thinking about Three Waters, but there are other areas, and you actually write in the book about during your time that there was a shift in the whole partnership concept. But when I'm just looking at co-governance, I think that we are using the same term, I think, for two different things.
And I think you're right. I prefer, and I think David Parker said this, treaty-based co-management. That's what I'm talking about. And then you're talking about, well, you know, there are other governmental activities, and we talk about co-governance. Is that the right way of delivering a particular service, or do you simply devolve the service to iwi? So you're right, there are two types of activities. What I focused on was treaty-based co-management. Insofar as co-governance as a general concept is concerned, there are legitimate arguments for and against, and we're seeing that played out in contemporary politics now.
Yeah, I actually think that because we use the same term for both, I think it's conflated.
No, I agree with you, and I inherited the term co-governance. If you were adopting a sort of a fresh start from first principles approach, I think, you'd talk about treaty-based co-management, and then... when you're talking about some of these other co-governance initiatives, and you refer to a few, you can have a principled debate on them. And this is what in opposition, where Seymour was raising principled opposition to aspects of co-governance, and people said he was a racist. No, he wasn't. He was raising principled arguments against, and to use the term racist in those circumstances is pathetic.
Just finish off. you've had an enormous impact. It doesn't really come through from reading the book, Yes, Minister, but it certainly comes through from reading this book, Hikupu Turangi. But I like this, you quote, I'm sorry, you're quoting here, but you quote, in life you can sit on the sidelines, litigate, comment and complain, but unless you enter the political arena with all the risk that entails, you cannot really get anything important done, which is basically a smack to the commentariat, which I guess includes me. But you have, Mr. Finlayson, had an enormous impact, and I think it's, looking back, I think he can be pretty proud. I think that the future will have to say some things will work out well, some things will not work out well. But goodness gracious me, you did not waste your 9 years on the stage. And I'm looking forward to your third book.
Well, I'm looking forward to it too, and that's why I'm getting a little bit paranoid, because I've got a busy legal practice. And I've got too many sideline activities. And once again, I'm haunted by the words of Professor Peter Norrish, my former professor of French, who said to me in 1979, for goodness sake, man, do a few things and do them well. So I'm about to resign from a whole lot of things because I really want that third book written. And for your listeners, it's a collection of essays by former attorneys general about the rule of law, and I came across quite a number of attorneys in my time, especially across the Five Eyes, and so I'm very keen to get people like Rob Nicholson from Canada and Dominic Grieve from England. I'd like Jody Wilson-Raybould from Canada to talk about their experiences as attorneys standing up for the rule of law. The other one I'd be really keen to get is Jeff Sessions, who we all thought was a good old boy from Alabama. But he got it as Attorney General. He got it and stood up to Trump, and Bully Boy fired him the day after the midterms in 2018. So these are big issues. And I recall years ago when we had a meeting of the various attorneys saying, you know, from time to time we should just talk about the rule of law and our role to protect it.
Well,
and,
I mean...
And that's a major issue today. And I come back to what Alan Greenspan said. He was head of the Federal Reserve when Reagan was president. What's the most important contributor to economic growth? And he said it's a no-brainer. It's the rule of law. And we've got to cherish it because it's under threat everywhere in places that you would not expect, namely the United States and England. And so it's not something you take for granted.
No, and there are big issues, particularly with tikanga and customary law coming into play in New Zealand. And I think
that they're all
roles, and it's really interesting.
Yeah, it is an interesting period, so we can deal with all those issues provided we're level-headed and don't flip out.
Okay. Christopher Finlayson, thank you so much.
My pleasure.